Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Karl Lozhachowski, and I will be your host for the day. Actually, Lauren will be your host. We did a brand new but pre-recorded program on Friday with scholar Erica Fudge. It's a really fascinating interview. I'm going to leave the main introduction up to Lauren, which is on the pre-recorded program. But before we get into that, I want to remind people that this Saturday, December 8th, is the hearing for Trey Smith. Trey Smith is an animal cruelty investigator with the Toronto Humane Society, and he ran into some trouble a little while ago during an animal cruelty investigation. The story of Cyrus. Cyrus was a dog who was trapped in an SUV in extremely hot temperatures. The SUV window was broken. Trey Smith got Cyrus out and got Cyrus the medical attention that he desperately needed at the time. And in the process, handcuffed the owner of the SUV to the SUV and left him there while he went to save Cyrus's life. The Ontario SPCA was none too happy about that, and Trey Smith has been on desk duty since then. So this is coming to us from the Toronto Humane Society website. This is the last chance to write in support for Trey Smith because the OSPCA hearing is now in 4 days. There has been no reprieve yet for Agent Trey Smith at the Ontario SPCA. At the Toronto Humane Society, we fear the worst. All of your pleas seem to have fallen on deaf ears. The Ontario SPCA has brought in Bay Street lawyers, and there will be a hearing on December 8th, 2007. The Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services, Rick Bartolucci, is Agent Smith's last hope. If you have not done so, please help Agent Smith by asking the Minister to intervene. The legislature at Queen's Park has reconvened on November 28th, so please fill in your MPP on what's been happening. The brave men and women on the front lines of animal cruelty investigation need your support. So if you go to the Toronto Humane Society website, which is torontohumanesociety.com, you can find contact information for the Honorable Rick Bartolucci, who is the Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services, and you can also find details on how you can contact your own MPP and how you can contact local Toronto newspapers like the Sunday Sun, the Monday Sun, City TV, and the Star, that sort of thing. So I really, really strongly encourage everyone to write in about this issue. It really is crucial that the animal cruelty investigators in Ontario and in all of Canada really do get, excuse the pun, but teeth to be able to do their work. And we need to send a strong message that that when animal cruelty cases do happen, that we want those agents to be able to act in the best interest of the animals first. And if you want more recent news coverage of Cyrus's miraculous recovery and Agent Smith's endless sort of David and Goliath battle for the right to do his job, again, go to the Toronto Humane Society website, torontohumanesociety.com, and check it out. And before we get into the interview with Erica Fudge, which is a really, really great interview, next week on the show we're going to have Marissa from Komondi on the show. And Komondi is a website that that sells lots of really great vegan and, I believe, fair trade goods. And she'll be giving away a few prizes next week. So if you are looking for some potential Christmas gifts for people, you'll definitely want to tune in. She'll be giving away a set of blessings tumblers with the word blessings in four different languages on them. They're made from the bottom of recycled wine bottles by Green Glass. And to some people, you might hear, oh, recycled wine bottles, that sounds like it might look recycled. But these are really, really beautiful and amazing pieces of artwork. And Marissa will also be giving away an organic hemp shoulder bag from Ecolution. So do tune in next week. It's going to be a great show. Without further ado, I'm going to play the pre-recorded, yet brand new, interview with Erica Fudge. This interview was actually done just this past Friday, and we're airing it today because Erica Fudge cannot do Tuesday interviews. So I will leave the main intro up to Lauren, and check it out.
Hi there. Welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. It's bright and early Friday morning. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, doing a crash course in pre-recorded technology. He's doing a great job. Today we're speaking with Dr. Erica Fudge, who is reader in literary and cultural studies in the English department at Middlesex University. She's also the director of the British Animal Studies Network. She's the associate editor for the humanities of the journal Society and Animals, and it's our great pleasure to have her on the program today. Carl and I both had the opportunity to read her book Animal, and we got really excited to speak with Erica, and so we're reaching her over an ocean, and we're going to talk with her today about all of her work on animals. We're going to concentrate on questions around history and also around cultural studies and reading images and looking at representation. So it's a great thrill to have her on the program today. So a warm welcome to you, Erica.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So I'm going to pose two very broad questions just to kick things off, which is really unfair to do to an academic, because I know we could spend the next 45 minutes just talking about these questions. But why history for you? Why have you been interested in history? And why animals? And then how do you see those two related? Why have you brought those two streams together?
Wow, that is a big question. Okay, why history? I don't know. I think, in a sense, you could say that at a certain point when I was doing my undergraduate degree, which was in literature and history, it was a joint degree, I got interested in the Renaissance. Now, whether I got interested at that moment because I was ready to be interested or whether it's the period that was interesting to me, I don't know. But I just was really interested in the period around the reign of Queen Elizabeth I and James I, and I sort of stuck with it. I think it's called the early modern period by a lot of scholars, myself included, and I think one of the things that's interesting about it is at the same time very alien from our own world. So there are things going on in that period that you look at and you think, that is extraordinary. How could they do that? And yet, simultaneously, there are things that are utterly recognizable. So it is this kind of version of where the modern world is coming from. And I think it's that contradiction between the alien and the similar that really interests me about the early modern period. Why animals is, well, there's all sorts of reasons for that. The scholarly reason is, very simply, to get money to do research, you have to find something that nobody else has done the research on. And nobody else has done any research on bear baiting. And I just thought it was a really interesting subject. So that's what I did my PhD on. But as well as that, of course, is other, I suppose, ethical questions that I was asking myself. I'm a vegetarian, and so on and so forth. And I think as this field, which is now called animal studies, developed, I was able to recognize that the scholarly interest I had taken up in writing a PhD on bear baiting was obviously related to the ethical questions I was asking myself in my other life as just a personal private citizen. I don't know, does that answer your question?
I think so. Can you tell us what bear baiting is?
Well, I mean, bear baiting is an absolutely horrible sport that does, I think, still continue in various parts of the world. But in Elizabethan England, to focus on that aspect, alongside the theatres like the Globe Theatre and the Swan Theatre on the south bank of the River Thames in the late 16th century were the baiting arenas. And very literally, on I think it was a Thursday and a Sunday, these bears, who were kept in kind of stables around the bear gardens, were brought out on chains. They'd had their teeth removed, they'd had their claws removed, and dogs were set on them. And a dog would get a prize, apparently, if it could pull a rosette from a bear's head. But I think, actually, the entertainment was simply watching the fight. That actually, it wasn't necessarily competitive. They didn't, you know, the audience didn't necessarily care who won and who lost. And so it was part of a form of entertainment which was premised upon cruelty. And alongside the bear baiting in the afternoon, I think you would get jugglers. There were stories about machines that would throw out apples into the audience and so on. So it was part of a bigger kind of entertainment. But the bear baiting was the central part of that entertainment. And you also got monkey baiting, which is even stranger, where a monkey dressed in human clothes sitting on a horseback would be sent out into the arena to be baited by dogs. And, you know, there's just what interested me was, how can Shakespeare be writing his plays, John Donne be writing his poems, these fantastic bits of literature, at the same time as this horrific entertainment is taking place.
Mm.
And so that was the kind of starting point of my research, was to ask, how can all these things be happening simultaneously? Because clearly you should not be able to just separate them out and say, oh, that's totally different. I wanted to trace the kind of cultural explanation, if you like, as to why people went to see bear baiting.
One of the themes that comes up in your work over and over again is, and I think that you use this term right away in the beginning of the interview, about contradictions. So how did you end up making sense of that, that seeming contradiction?
Well, I think you recognize that the contradictions are meaningful in themselves. I think rather than trying to come up with a simple answer, that you just sort of sit with all the possible answers in front of you and recognize that the fact that they are all available at the same moment is the interesting thing.
Mm.
And I think it still exists now. I think, you know, it's utterly contradictory that I've just had a conversation with somebody who's thinking about meat eating, that, you know, her question, why is it that we will eat this animal and not that animal? Because clearly it's not about taste. There's other sort of cultural things going on. Why is it that a person can have a pet and love that animal absolutely and still eat meat and not see any kind of inherent contradiction in that? So I think animals are a point at which simple explanations seem to break down, and what you're faced with is fascinating contradictions. So I suppose for me, I would never want to try to flatten out the contradictions into simple single meanings. I would always want to just sit and look at the contradictions, because I think that is what is in operation in society, whether it's the early modern period or contemporary culture.
Mm. I think one of the things, too, that's coming out of the literature that's associated with animal studies is the argument, I think Ken Shapiro makes this argument as well, lots of others do, that when we're talking about animals, we're also talking about constructions about the human or humanity as well. And so people, I think, would think, well, you know, you're doing animal studies, it's about animals, presumably, but it's also really stories about and constructions and ideas about who we think we are.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've actually now started saying to people, oh, I'm in a field called animal studies, and the key question there is, what does it mean to be a human?
Mm.
That is how I explain to people what animal studies is. Now, obviously, that is simplifying in all sorts of ways. But I think, for me, that is what's going on, and that's not simply my interest. I think that is what the early modern period is interested in. So when I was reading about reason and books about reason, there were no books on animal reason. But what I discovered is that the books that were writing about human reason were full of animals. That actually, these writers could not talk about humans without talking about animals. And so, by default, animal studies is human studies. It's just coming at it from a particular perspective in which, I suppose, you are recognizing that the human is a status that sort of exists in difference. It's not essential. There's no true thing that makes a human a human. The human is only really ever thought about in relation to all sorts of other creatures, many of which are animals, some of which are robots, artificial intelligence, and so on.
Is that ever kind of sticky work to do, because you're sort of put into a position, I know that this is a term coming out of post-humanism, and others have used this as well, around decentering the human subject. And even when we're studying, presumably we're studying others, we always are necessarily having to come back to ourselves in some ways.
Absolutely. It seems like a total contradiction. And I think, you know, the way I've thought about this as a historian is to recognize that every document that I read is always going to be a document constructed by a human. If it's writing about an animal, great. I'm not dealing with paleoanthropology or anything like that. I deal with written documents. So I am always dealing with what people have said about animals. And in one sense, that people could argue that that still is very orthodox. It's just another version of the history of ideas. But I suppose my argument is I use those documents in, I suppose, a broadly speaking deconstructive way to see how claims for human culture, for example, are always reliant upon a thing that is animal. And therefore, it's not a thing called pure human culture.
Mm.
And so therefore, a history cannot be pure human history. It should be, if you're looking at something in its whole, this history that takes in the role of animals, the agency of animals in how we live our lives, whether you're thinking about the importance of the horse to transport in 16th century London, or, you know, the role of dogs in 19th century society, or so on. you're actually recognizing that those animals impact on the way humans can live their lives, and therefore to write history, you have to include them.
One of the things that struck me too reading your work, as an aside, I think I was in grade 5 when I realized there was something going on in the news. I'm not sure what it was. This is Reagan era. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking things are getting worse. I didn't have the language of progress in my mind. But I think that growing up in Canada in the time that I did, and just in Western culture in general, I was sort of very bodily and intuitively attached to a notion of progress. And that's one of the things that you take on in some of your work, and in particular it was making me think about what you were saying about bear baiting. That's the kind of thing that people love to look back on and say, oh, how could we be so awful?
Mm.
And you have a different rendering of what's going on there and how it relates to today in terms of a discussion about progress.
Well, I mean, absolutely, and I think I'm very influenced by the work of someone like Michel Foucault in this. In that it would be very, very, very simple to just say, well, look, there's no bear baiting in England. It was banned in the early 19th century. Therefore, things must be better. We have progressed. We've become a nicer society for, in England, banning bear baiting. And you know, I don't in any way dispute that that is a step forward. But, of course, what has gone along with that kind of progress is the increasing amount of battery farming that takes place, the industrialization of agriculture, and so on and so forth. You know, I'm always shocked at how cheap leather goods can be these days. Because you just think, well, what is going on that can allow a pair of shoes that are made of leather to be so cheap? There's something awful about that. There's something terrifying about that. And so I think progress, I view as a very problematic term because it kind of lets us off the hook. You know, we can look back at something like bear baiting and say, well, look, we're better than them. And it all feels like it's okay, when in fact we are engaged in other kinds of exercises. And I think predominantly the exercises of abuse and cruelty that we're involved in are hidden. So they are, you know, abattoirs. They are the industrial farms, which are a long way away from the cities and so on. Whereas bear baiting, in some ways, you can say it's a more honest kind of cruelty because it's happening there. It's in your face. There's no other, you know, place it's going to apart from the theatre, this bear baiting arena.
Can you trace a bit of a history then for us of two parallel streams of invisibility and visibility, and how the visual representation of cruelty has changed? What's going on there when you talk about these various different places, the battery cages or the abattoirs that we don't see? It seems that a lot of what was happening in the industrial period is a lot of these sort of large-scale uses of animals, this exploitation of animals became... I know that it changed around World War II in the United States and in Canada, that the factory farms really started to get more and more closed. There was sort of the initial period of like, come look at the amazing technology that we have. But things have increasingly gone behind closed doors. Can you speak a little bit about this relationship to visibility and invisibility?
Well, I think you can go right back to a text like Norbert Elias's book, The Civilizing Process, which is a study of the emergence of manners as we would recognize them in the late medieval and early modern period. And what he says in that is that basically a lot of behaviors had to become private. And you know, it's very comic when you read some of the things that are said. So, you know, in the late 16th century, advice manuals are still saying things like, you know, you must not go out into the corridor and pee. And this is to educated people. You think, my God, they were peeing in the corridor. And for us, this is appalling, but the reason it's appalling to us is because we have been educated by the civilizing process to urinate behind closed doors. You know, bodies are suddenly secret private things. They're not publicly to be displayed. And this is a process which we call manners. And what emerges from that is an increasing amount of shame. Shame about bodily functions, shame about being in public and doing inappropriate things. And I think one possible way of thinking about the separation of the kinds of meat industries, if we're using that as our example, from everyday life is that it's like it's everything's become more hygienic. One argument is that with industrialization and urbanization, people are separated from the natural world. Literally, you move to a city from the country. This is one of the things that's happening in industrialization. And so alongside that, you lose that sense of the bodiliness of the world, if you like, the dirtiness of the world. The fact that, you know, you can live next door to the cow you are going to slaughter. Now, of course, that bodiliness continues. People live with pigs in their back gardens, in their backyards, and so on, until the early 20th century. But actually, a lot of the violence that would have been much more present in a kind of mundane way is separated off. We become more shameful and more ashamed of bodies and all that kind of unhygienic stuff in personal terms. So we have better table manners as we would perceive them. But we also become more fearful of the unhygienic in larger terms. And I think the unhygienic involves the presence of animals, the presence of dead animals, or the presence of killing animals in particular. So I think that's one possibility as to why that separation has taken place. Now, there is another position which says, well, actually, you know, while the industrialization did produce urbanization, did lead to more people living in cities than had before, cities themselves are full of animals. And Diana Donald, for example, who's an art historian, wrote a fantastic essay that was published, you know, about 5 years ago in the journal Art History, in which she was looking at the ways in which cruelty to animals is made very visible in propaganda surrounding animal cruelty in the period. So the RSPCA, or the SPCA as it was for some of the 19th century, uses very visual representations of cruelty as a way of raising the issue. And so people don't want to see it, but when they see it, it's seen as propagandistic. It's seen as a moral function. So I think, you know, it's, as with everything else, I would not want to say there's a single reason for the movement of slaughterhouses, because I'm sure it's also for public health reasons that you need to separate slaughterhouses from, you know, the urban centres and so on. But I also think that there is a kind of intellectual question about cleanliness, which is, you know, simultaneously urban cleanliness, but it's a kind of moral cleanliness, a figurative cleanliness as well.
Mm. It's making me think about Mary Douglas's work on purity, notions of purity and dirt.
Oh yeah, and you know, dirt is matter that's out of place. There's nothing inherently dirty about dirt. It's just where it lives in society, where it exists. So, you know, soil is perfect in one place but imperfect in another. But those boundaries are created by us.
Mm.
They're not saying anything about the nature of dirt, if you like.
I thought it was interesting that you brought up this, the RSPCA, I suppose. And one of the things that interests me about history, and in particular your reading of history, and I'm just looking at Montaigne right now, so that's my own bias. I'm not sure which chapter it's in, but you talk about Montaigne and how there is a tendency to, I think it's Keith Thomas, that paints in rather broad strokes the idea that history, the history of animals or the history of the treatment of animals, is somehow unitary or homogeneous in some ways in terms of its cruelty. And then there, of course, were voices of dissent throughout history. And Montaigne seems like an interesting character, and he's one that you focus on a little bit. I was wondering if you could tell us more about his voice.
Well, I mean, I think Montaigne is just, everyone should read Montaigne. I have no hesitation in suggesting that. I think he's a fantastic writer. I mean, broadly speaking, I think Montaigne is coming out of a tradition which is sceptical. And in the early modern period, he's writing in the late 16th century, the sceptical tradition was a very philosophical tradition which was arguing very simply, how do we know it is this? What do I know, Montaigne is asking. And the question, the answer that he comes up with is, I can only know what I can know. And my knowledge, therefore, is sort of biased, sort of subjective, sort of limited. And so I, therefore, need to kind of recognize that as I'm thinking about who I am as a human being, for example. And so there, he's led to, you know, think about what an animal might be thinking. His very famous question is, you know, he writes, you know, when I play with my cat, am I playing with her or is she playing with me? And I think that's just a fantastic question, because he is, you can imagine this little scene in late 16th century France, this gentleman sitting there with his cat and suddenly thinking, the cat thinks I'm the object of its pleasure. I'm not the only person who's objectifying here. There is this other being called cat who may well be thinking, who the hell is this? What is this human who's playing with me? And he actually says, you know, sometimes the cat stops playing before I do. So it's not like the cat is this little object for his pleasure. The cat is a being unto itself. And so what Montaigne, I think, is doing when he's thinking about ethical relationships with animals is he's having constantly in mind not kind of abstract questions about pain and so on, but actually questions about the possibility of animals being subject, being, if you like, persons, in a broad philosophical term, and what the implication would be if that was the case. And the fact that he can't find a reason that allows him to say animals are not subjects, they are only objects, the fact that he's incapable of saying that philosophically means that he has to assume an ethical relationship is necessary. So, you know, he talks about hunting, and of course, paradoxically, he does go hunting. But as he goes hunting, he says, you know, he looks at the tears in the eyes of the stag, and he realizes that something awful is happening when he's hunting. So he's not hunting as if chasing down an object. He's not dealing with lesser beings than himself. He's thinking about other beings. And I think, you know, he is, in those terms, slightly out of kilter with the early modern period, but he's also very influential in the early modern period. So Keith Thomas, from my recollection, does two distinct things with Montaigne in his book, The Man and the Natural World. On the one hand, he says Montaigne's eccentric, and then on the other hand, he says everyone's reading it. And I sort of just thought, well, how can both of those things be going on at once? Because I would have thought if everyone's reading him, they're willing to think about his ideas. So I think, you know, Montaigne is one of the people who, for me, offers this really interesting alternative way of thinking about specifically the early modern period. But I do think that, you know, generally skeptical questions are interesting even now. And I think someone like Jacques Derrida, whose later work was looking at the question of the animal, is coming out of that same tradition.
Mm. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back and continue talking. I'd like to speak more about representation and some of the ideas that emerge from animal.
Okay.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Erica Fudge, and before the break we were speaking about Montaigne and his seemingly still radical positions, I think, in many ways today on animals. And I wanted to shift the conversation a little bit to talk more about contemporary representations of animals. So, Erica, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks.
So I know that you spent quite a bit of time researching fables, and I know, too, that you looked at animals in film. And I will just let you jump into it anywhere about why study contemporary. This is sort of the reverse question that I asked you initially. Why study these contemporary images, and how can this, I guess, how can this relate to the development of animal ethics or advocacy? What relevance does it have now to understand, for example, what Lassie Come Home is about?
Well, I think, I mean, I can again offer you a very practical explanation as to why I ended up doing some stuff on modern stuff, because my research is, I've talked about early modern, but I think in terms of teaching, I felt it would be much more interesting to get my undergraduate students to think about contemporary representations. And so, you know, without actually flagging the module that I taught on animals as a kind of ethical module, that there was hope that students who were reading the text, thinking about the issues, would then recognize that they were dealing with ethical questions. So I chose a selection of, I thought, fairly conventional literary texts. So we began with Black Beauty, a fable. We moved through things like Jack London's Call of the Wild, Virginia Woolf's Flush, Eric Knight's Lassie Come Home, and so on. So pretty conventional texts, but we're asking questions about them that maybe had not been asked. So, for example, I don't know if you know Virginia Woolf's Flush. It's a fantastic little novel, which is a fictional biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the poet's pet spaniel. And it is this wonderful kind of comic attempt to think, what would it be like to represent the life of an animal, a life of a dog? And at one point, you know, she's working out how can she explain what the dog experienced when it ran through the street, when she doesn't have words to represent what smell is like, and that's how dogs experience the world. And so it's a very, very self-conscious text thinking about how do you go about representing. Now, for many critics of Virginia Woolf, it's seen as a very secondary text. If you look at studies of Virginia Woolf, not many of them spend a great deal of time looking at Flush, which is very interesting, of course. You know, it's marginalization of this text. Why? Because it's an animal? I don't know. I think that's a strong possibility. So in terms of why I would study those, on one level, texts like Flush I felt, allowed my students to really think about wider issues of the nature of representation. So they weren't simply thinking about representing animals. They were thinking about, you know, what do novelists do when they represent anything? What kinds of questions, ethical or otherwise, do they have to ask? What kinds of techniques might they use to do their work best? You know, why is it that, for example, Black Beauty, which is a novel told from the perspective of the horse, so it's Black Beauty's autobiography, why is that a technique that we have to assume was specifically chosen? What was it supposed to be able to do? Why has Virginia Woolf refused that and is writing a biography, so the third-person perspective rather than the first-person? So those questions were very, very literary questions, if you like. But what came out of them, of course, without me kind of forcing the issue, were other wider questions. So I remember one week coming into a seminar, and the student was sitting there and saying to the rest of the group as they were sitting around, I was looking at this website about where Kentucky Fried Chicken get their chickens from. Oh, it's disgusting, and so on. I hadn't told him to go and look at this website. And for me, I felt that that was a much, much more productive way of getting him to engage with an ethical question than if I had said to them, go away and look at how disgusting battery farming is, and so on. And so I guess to sort of give one answer to your question, I'm interested in contemporary cultural representations because I think they allow us into ways of thinking that go beyond simply looking at that novel, that painting, and so on, but that do it in really interesting ways.
One of the critiques that comes out of looking at fables and various different other representations, really, of animals is that animals are often configured as metaphors. The KFC example is an interesting one because often in advertisements, you have the animals speaking, you know, come and eat me kind of thing. And there's this, you point to this in animal, that there's this tendency in this history of taking on animals' voice. And of course, it's done in various different ways, but I'm wondering, I guess, in a convoluted way, if you can talk about agency and metaphors and speaking animals.
Well, I think it's a very, very interesting question, and again, it's a very complicated one because, in some ways, if you look back at Aesop's fables, you know, the fable of, you know, the hare and the tortoise, for example, clearly we are not meant to read that as being in any way about a hare or a tortoise. It is a fable about, you know, slowly and steadily wins the race. That's the moral to that fable. And so animals in that kind of fable tradition are clearly simply representations of a single human trait. So the hare is this flighty being, whereas the tortoise is slow and steady. The fox is always cunning, the lion is always regal, and so on and so forth. And in that tradition, no animal is ever really an animal at all, or if there is a kind of animalized presence, it's just there as, I would have thought, ornamentation in that tradition. That tradition is simply using animals to talk about human traits, to talk about how humans might go about living. But I think what kind of also exists is another tradition which is looks like a fable, but which is also able to bring in more presence of animals. I think Black Beauty, to talk about one that I've already mentioned, is one attempt to do this, and I'm not sure it is wholly successful in all sorts of ways, although of course it had massive impact on the way people lived with horses, so you know, you can't underestimate what it did. Because I think one of the problems with Black Beauty is you read it, it's this first person narrative, I was a little horse, I was forced to do this, that and the other, and it actually sounds a lot like, I always think, a rather disgruntled English vicar talking about terrible things that have happened to him. So you sort of seem to lose the horse as the horse is speaking human language. But as I've said, that text had a huge impact on things like bearing reins, the kind of reining devices that were used on horses. And horses were, in the main, treated more kindly because people had seen the kinds of issues raised in Black Beauty. So I think, you know, animals are metaphors in some texts, but other writers try to use them as other things. And, you know, sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. I've written about the film Babe, where if you read the Dick King Smith little children's novel on which it's based, it's clearly a novel about categorization and about how you are able to break beyond the limits that you are seen to exist within, so that a pig can be a sheepdog. That is possible. That is, you know, if you've got the talent, you should be able to do it. Whereas the film, which depicts, of course, famously, this, you know, real pig sheep, you know, herding sheep, is moving in all sorts of other ways, because you are confronted with a real animal rather than this kind of story that is really not about pigs.
My background in, I guess where I began my journey with academics was in women's studies. And in the 1990s, there was a lot of conversations going on and debates going on about appropriation, taking on the voice of someone else and what that means. And I wonder about the relevance of those debates to thinking about animals, that even if it's effective sometimes to take on the voice or to represent the voice of an animal, is there also a negation involved in some ways? Does it presume a kind of knowing?
I think absolutely. I think in more extreme terms than in women's studies, because, of course, you know, the underlying principle idea of women's studies is that women themselves should be given a voice, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, be ventriloquized through patriarchal culture. And I think the thing with our relationship with animals, of course, is that the voices that animals have are not voices that we can understand in those sorts of ways. And so on one level, human relationships with animals will always have the animal as the silent object who is spoken for or spoken on behalf of by a human, in, you know, if the human is pro-animal. And so it's a very basic sense that animals can't speak for themselves. But I think you're absolutely right that sometimes in novels and in films, to use those examples, you do lose sight of the fact that it is an animal that's being represented, because it becomes so, I suppose, humanized. Mm. I think, you know, a lot of cartoons are absolutely follow that trajectory, that, you know, there's nothing particularly animally in a lot of cartoons. And so, I can't remember its title now, the film about the escape from a chicken farm.
Oh, Chicken Run.
Thank you, Chicken Run. It's very entertaining, but what it's entertaining is that it translates the kind of genre film of the escape from the prisoner of war camp to chickens. Now, is that a film that is going to make people think about the chickens they eat? I'm not sure. I don't think it is, because I think you forget the presence of the chickens as chickens in that film, which is not to say it's not a very entertaining film. It's just not a film that is able really to make any moral and ethical statements. So I think you're right that it is very, very difficult to find a way around kind of speaking for animals as actually kind of silencing animals and missing the animals out altogether. Mm. I think that's my concern when it comes to something like Black Beauty, that the horse just vanishes.
I think that in feminist terms, people have talked about the retreat response. I don't like that either, the idea that, well, we couldn't possibly do it, and it's so problematic to try to represent animals and to take on their voices, although that can be a powerful gesture, but it's too dangerous, we're not going to go there at all. I don't know if that's necessarily a better route either.
No, I think you're right, because then you end up just not speaking about them at all, or speaking for them at all. I mean, I just always think that we have to recognise how problematic speaking for, speaking on behalf of animals is, but also recognise that if we didn't do it, there would be this awful vacuum in which all sorts of possible things could happen without ever being questioned. Mm. So, you know, it's anthropomorphism, the making human of the animal, works very well in ethical terms, but can also work to just get rid of the animal. So you end up just with another human that happens to be furry in that representation.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up anthropomorphism, because I think that that's a bad word. You know, that's the thing we're supposed to not do. And I think that you and others have pointed to the ethical possibilities in anthropomorphism, that it isn't necessarily so bad to identify, and we're always going to be identifying on human terms because we're human.
And I think, I mean, very simple reason being exactly what you said before, that if we don't anthropomorphize, the alternatives are either that we regard animals as objects that are beyond our ability to represent, or we don't represent them at all. And, you know, so I think we have to. I think it's also inevitable that we will, especially if you're thinking about pets and so on, that, you know, somebody lives with a pet, that pet has become a little person in the house. However much they are attempting to, you know, my dogs are dogs, they're not children, it's still a being who has an individual character who you relate to as a person in your house. And I think, you know, in many ways, some people can go what I would perceive as too far. So you've got this idea of the fur baby, that the dog is the child substitute. In fact, no, it's not the child substitute. It is a child.
Mm.
And I think that's a problem. But the other end of the spectrum is to just have animals as objects, which is another kind of problem. So I think anthropomorphism is a necessary presence. I was going to say necessary evil, but actually I think that's probably not a helpful way of putting it. It's necessary, and it can also serve a function. Because my perspective, when I went to see the film Babe, was that it was horrendous to hear little piglets saying goodbye to their mother as a metal udder was lowered down to them. It sort of laid bare that kind of factory farming in a way that you can imagine a documentary film would find very difficult to do, let alone to be able to do it in 30 seconds.
Hmm. You want to go back to pets, because I know that you, I believe you're writing about pets right now in terms of a book.
I am. It's a nice little book, which is always pleasant to write. Okay. It feels like slightly less to have to think about, but of course there's not less to think about because pets are so, well, important to people and so complex as well, because they are animals and they are people. I've just said that. They are, you know, in our homes, but they cannot speak our language. And so I think, you know, they're really, really interesting. And what else I'm interested in, because I'm specifically looking at kind of philosophical debates about pets, is just at the moment how many current philosophers are turning to think about pets. Donna Haraway famously is writing about her relationship with her dog, who she does agility training with.
Mm-hmm.
Derrida, in one of his later essays, wrote a lot about, you know, his relationship with his cat and how that makes him think differently. And I think pets are really interesting because they are these, well, they're border-crossing creatures. This is what a lot of people have written, that they're not human and they're not animal. They're kind of human animal in the truest sense of the word. They have names. We don't eat them, but they're still furry and they don't speak our language. And so pets, I think, are really, really interesting. And the way that people have thought about and tried to make sense of pets is very interesting.
Mm. How do you see your work then contributing? What is the piece that you bring in particular to that conversation about pets?
Well, I suppose in many ways I am attempting to just bring together a lot of ideas that come from very disparate places. So people end up writing about pets, not necessarily in books that are about pets. If you see what I mean. So people might not go to them to find out and think about animals. But it's also to just take seriously things that have not been taken seriously. So I was reading these histories of the home, because clearly the notion of home is very important when you're thinking about pets, and was absolutely astonished that people did not write about pets when they wrote about the home in modernity. And actually, I'm not sure what the statistics are, but I would have thought the number of homes in North America, in Western Europe, that have pets in them, there'll be a huge proportion. And so to not talk about those animals is to not talk about something really important when we're thinking about what a home is. And so, you know, it's another one of the silencing, another one of the marginalizations that has happened in scholarship, that animal studies, you know, is part of what animal studies is trying to do, which is to recognize the centrality and the importance of animals in all the ways in which we live and think in the world. And I think pets, because they are sitting next to us as we are sitting at home, so they are the most homely creatures we've got, become really, really important in our understandings of what an animal is, what a human is, what a home is, and so on.
We only have about 5 more minutes left, and I'm going to do probably exactly what you didn't want me to do, which is to turn it over to you. I know that we haven't touched too much on brutal reasoning, animals, rationality, and humanity in early modern England, if you wanted to talk about that book or some of the questions in particular besides pets and all the associated questions that come from that, where your head's been at lately, or where the future of animal studies is going, or where you'd like to see your own work going?
Wow. Well, I think one way of thinking about the future of animal studies, I can't say where it's going. I can attempt to see where I think things are really interesting. I mean, I've been given this funding to set up what's called the British Animal Studies Network. You mentioned it in the introduction. And what that gave me the opportunity to do, which was fantastic, was to literally sit down and think, what people have I read who I would like to meet? So I, you know, literally looked at my bookshelves and thought, well, I'd like to meet her. I'd like to hear what else he's got to say, and so on. And so, I mean, fairly limited funds. I didn't have a total free reign. I have been able to, you know, get these really really interesting people, some, you know, really important people in the field of animal studies, to come to these meetings. And there's usually an audience of about 25, 30 people from really different disciplinary backgrounds, and think about particular issues, particular ideas. And so I, one of my hopes for the discipline is that we keep talking across disciplinary boundaries, that animal studies, you know, continues to produce work that recognizes the importance of other fields. I know with my work in the Animal Studies Group, which is a group of British scholars, which is, you know, a philosopher, an art historian, a cultural theorist, a couple of other historians and so on, that I have learned a huge amount because my friend, the human geographer, said to me, oh, you really should look at this, Erica. And so, you know, I've been given books to look at, given articles to look at that I would never have gone to look at without those people, without that kind of contact. So for me, I really hope that animal studies continues to grow in those directions, because I think if we continue to do that, we will get continue to get a much fuller sense of how we live in the world with animals, how we coexist, how we fight against, how we make meaning with, how we make meaning of ourselves with animals. I'm not sure I can tell you that there are particular trends that are becoming particularly interesting or of particular use to animal studies. I think it's still in its early stages, which is really nice because it means that things are very open. So, you know, in terms of my work, I've talked to you about the work I've done on pets, but one of the other things that I've enjoyed doing coming out of some of the teaching I've done here at Middlesex is writing about very popular novels. I've talked about Black Beauty, a novel like Lassie Come Home, which when I looked to find some, you know, secondary reading to have a look at what people say, virtually nobody had written about. They've written stuff on the TV series, which is a very, very different thing to Eric Knight's, I think, socialist realist novel about economic degradation, and that uses the dog as a model for what happens when society breaks down, what happens when the dog leaves the home, what happens when the pit closes, are the same question asked in two different ways. And I think, I suppose if I wanted to speak generally about what I'm doing, it is this returning to, I think, very conventional sources, and they're conventional sources in early modern materials that I look at, as well as contemporary materials, and sort of taking them seriously, recognizing that Lassie is a book about a dog, and that it's got lots of very interesting things to say, even as it's a book about a dog, because I think people want books to say interesting things despite the fact that they're about dogs, despite the fact that they're about animals, when actually they're saying interesting things and they're about animals. So another early modern example would be Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, an absolutely central text about, you know, early modern psychology. And at the beginning of that, he says, in this book, I want to show how a man differs from a dog. Nobody had ever picked that up. And, you know, this is a very clear statement of intent that, for me, it was just like, okay, well, what does that mean? How are you going to do that? Why has nobody looked at that before? Why has nobody thought that was worth thinking about? Because I think what people did was relegate that to metaphor. He doesn't really mean how a man differs from a dog, when actually I think he did. And so I suppose if I was going to characterize where I'm going, is just to continue reading these very orthodox texts and take them seriously when they talk about animals, because I think they themselves are writing seriously about animals.
Erica, it was really a joy to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
It really resonated with me when you were saying that, you know, who are the people that you're reading and you'd like to meet, because, of course, I really wanted to speak with you, and I look forward to actually meeting you in the flesh sometime soon, I hope.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fudge.
Okay, nice to speak to you.
Bye now. We were just speaking with Dr. Erica Fudge. She is the author of many different texts, but most recently, Brutal Reasoning, Animals, Rationality, and Humanity in Early Modern England. She also contributed to the Killing Animals book by the Animal Studies Group. And we were talking today about her work also in the text representing animals and her own text called Animal, which is an excellent book to check out. It's a wonderful, not only a wonderful introduction, but just a great cultural studies book about animals. And I really encourage people to look into her work. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you want to contact us, you can write us animalvoices@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback, ideas for upcoming shows, critiques, that kind of thing. And also, you should check out our new website, animalvoices.ca. there's lots of places that you can enter into that website and see, I guess, listen to our very extensive archive of 200 and plus shows. And also, thank you to Karl Orzechowski, who came in today and did a great job with teching. Bye for now.